Hello, everyone. Thanks again. Brendan Stone here from Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. And I see everybody's ready. It's great to see a semicircle of people here assembled today in such a cold night, wearing watermelon pins and insignia for Palestine. It's very much appreciated. So thank you very much. Today, of course, we have Dan Kovalik speaking on a very important issue with a very important new book. And I should say that this morning, I woke up and I turned on the Taylor Report, 89.5 CIUT-FM in Toronto. And Phil Taylor was actually interviewing Dan's co-author, Jeremy Kuzmarov. And it was a 45-minute interview. And it was actually a spectacular interview that delved into how the United States manages the information space. In other words, people don't have a lot of knowledge about what happened in Syria and how the United States instigated a regime change in that country. Dan's co-author incredibly gave a kind of Edward S. Herman style analysis about the media, about the US State Department, about interventions and wars. We're gonna make that available on our website. We're gonna send that out in our newsletter. We're gonna attach it to any media related to tonight's event. I just wanted to say we're very fortunate to have such spectacular coverage. It's all thanks to Dan and the tour that he's doing. Now, I know we have difficulty combating propaganda. What you hear about Syria is a narrative, right? Somebody has created and concocted a narrative for you to believe. And fortunately, there are voices out there like Dan and Jeremy. You see people on YouTube and other programs who talk about the geopolitics of the world. And what Dan has done is actually incredibly brave and goes above and beyond, because he's actually been to Syria at least a couple times. Most recently, he went after the regime change. And as a journalist with guides, he was able to go into Al-Qaeda-controlled areas, places that are not safe, but he actually went into this place, Daniel among the lions, I suppose you could say. We're really, really privileged to have someone who has this kind of direct engagement with the issue. So Dan has he's gonna talk about his book, which is written very clearly. He speaks very clearly. There's gonna be a question period and such after. We ask that you hold your questions, of course. People that come to these events are familiar with how it works. So everyone will have a chance to talk about the issues, ask Dan questions. It'll be great. So we'll get to that and I'll explain how that works when the time comes. So I think it's time, very shortly, to have Dan begin his talk. I will give him a formal introduction. Dan Kovalik served as in-house counsel at the United Steelworkers of America for 26 years at its headquarters in Pittsburgh. He has been a labor and human rights lawyer since graduating from Columbia Law School in 1993. He's represented plaintiffs in human rights cases arising out of egregious abuses in Columbia. He also taught international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He's the author of many books, including The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters, and Why You Should Care. And he received the David W. Mills Mentoring Fellowship from Stanford Law School, the Serena Shim Award for Uncompromised Integrity in Journalism, and Iran's 15th Farabi International Award. Dan Kovalik lives in Pittsburgh, and he personally visited Syria, as I said, more than twice, including very recently. So, Dan, thank you very much for bringing your book and yourself today.
Thank you very much. Wow, that was a very nice introduction. I actually feel like, well, I guess I did a few things in my life, so that's good. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I really do appreciate it. Syria, of course, I'm sure most of you have experienced, has been one of the more divisive issues amongst the peace movement. I've seen it close up. It was really tore the peace movement apart in Pittsburgh, where I'm from, but I know in other places too. And if people opposed the U.S. intervention there, they were called Assadists and everything else. And I kind of want to break that down. I think that it was a mistake for the peace movement, for the left, not to have defended Syria more, not to have defended Libya more. And people were very much taken in by the propaganda, by the vilification of people like Muammar Gaddafi and Assad. Even I will say, I was just on Democracy Now! On Friday, and I generally like Democracy Now!, but I feel they played a fairly treacherous role in terms of those two issues. So I want to break that down. First of all, in terms of Syria, and I had dinner with some of your friends tonight, and as I mentioned, what has been lost in Syria is not only a tragedy for the Syrians, but for the world. My friend Roger Harris, who's he's a Marxist activist, he lives out in the Bay Area. He also happens to be a bird biologist, and he takes people on tour around the world. Very prominent people, rock stars, and Saudi princes, and whatnot. Anyway, that's how he makes his living. And he said for a while he was working with the U.S. State Department on their World Leaders Program, in which the State Department was taking people around the world to promote leaders. I don't know exactly how they were doing that, but that's not the important part. And my friend Roger Harris would help them on these tours. And at one point, this was 20 years ago, Roger asked these two people in the State Department who were heading up this program, he said, well, what country do people most like visiting? And the two people from the State Department said, oh, it's not even close. Invariably, it's Syria. Everyone loves to go to Syria. It's peaceful. It's friendly. It's a, mosaic of different religions, ethnicities, where people get along. It has incredible ancient antiquities from every major religion, Islam, Christianity, and others. The head of St. John the Baptizer is there, and the streets and cobblestones where St. Paul and St. Peter walked. And that Syria is gone. And I almost want to cry when I say that. And the U.S. and Canada and other Western countries with their partners in the Gulf and Israel are responsible. In fact, what Americans are never told, and you would never, your kids or grandkids would never be told this in school, you're going to learn about two world wars that we've had, World War I and World War II. I don't need to describe what they are. You know what I'm talking about. But between 2011 and 2024, there was a world war against Syria that you have not been told. At one time, the ambassador from Syria to the United Nations said they had collected passports amongst the violent insurgents from 101 different countries. There's only 200 countries on it. Okay. So over half the countries in the world contributed fighters to overthrow the government in Syria. Billions and billions of dollars were spent to overthrow the government. And who were they supporting to overthrow the government? Terrorist groups. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and others. And they were successful to the point that the new leader of Syria was the number two guy in Al-Qaeda after Osama bin Laden. Al-Qaeda has taken over Syria, and your government and my government helped make it happen. And I'll tell you why I think they chose these forces for that. But I need to give you a little history first that either you might have forgotten or maybe didn't know. you know, Gore Vidal, and again, sadly, I am an American, so I'm going to mostly talk from the U.S. perspective. I also think my country is the most maligned force in the world. As Martin Luther King said years ago, the U.S. is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and I think that's still true. So at least you got that going for you, that you're not the United States. But so when you talk about the support of terrorist groups in West Asia, which is the preferred moniker now over the Middle East, of course, you can go back pretty far, but let's just go back to June of 1979, when the U.S. began supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, right? One of the leaders of which was Osama bin Laden. And the prevailing narrative that you've been told and that most people believe is that the U.S. supported the Mujahideen to confront the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. But the Soviet Union wasn't in Afghanistan yet. As we learned from Brzezinski, the national security advisor of Jimmy Carter, years later, Brzezinski said the goal was to bring the Soviet Union into Afghanistan. And to, in his words, give the Soviets their Vietnam. And it worked. And so in 1980, the beginning of 1980, so 6 months after the U.S. began supporting terrorist groups in Afghanistan against a secular socialist government, the Soviet Union did invade, at the request of that government, by the way, to oppose these terrorist groups. But ultimately, as you know, the Soviet Union, I think it's fair to say, was defeated and they retreated. Actually, the secular government lasted another 6 months after the Soviets left, but ultimately fell. The Taliban took over. The Taliban, just to be clear, did not grow out of the Mujahideen, but it was another similar group that ended up becoming victorious in Afghanistan, but all because the U.S. was supporting the Mujahideen to begin with. And of course, then you had this strange thing where, of course, after 9/11, Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden were blamed for 9/11, so the U.S. says, okay, now we're going to war against our friend, Osama bin Laden. They didn't put it that way, but that was the fact, right? I mean, and again, really, the book 1984 has so much, I just keep thinking of it, right? That, you know, the idea, oh, we were always at war with East Asia. You know, this idea that, oh, we're always at war with Al-Qaeda. Well, it's obviously not. But for several years after 9/11, the U.S. did, to some extent, go to war with Al-Qaeda. It actually partnered with countries like Russia and Iran to do that. And later would betray Iran, despite Iran's help in that war. But then we learn, and I always tell people to read it, every speech I give about Syria or the region, I tell people, go back and look at the New Yorker article from 2007 by Seymour Hersh. And it's not behind a paywall, okay? It's called The Redirection. And Hersh says by 2005, so 4 years after 9/11, the U.S. decides we don't care about Al-Qaeda. In fact, we are now going to partner with Al-Qaeda to go after our real enemies, Syria, Iran, Libya, Lebanon, Somalia, etc. And so, as he exposed in the New Yorker, the U.S. began working with Al-Qaeda and other groups. In particular, their main goal was for regime change in Iran, But they knew to do that, they would have to first go through Syria. They would have to overthrow the Assad government in Syria. And so they began the process of supporting and empowering these groups. Of course, before they got to Syria, right before, the U.S. overthrew Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. The left in the U.S., for the most part, did not care. They were told Muammar Gaddafi was this brutal dictator, he was a bad guy. And again, people like Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! More or less cheerlead the overthrow of Gaddafi. And what has been the result? I mean, I think a lot of you know, there's not a unified Libya. It's divided at least into two different camps, between two different warlords. And for the first time in memory, slaves are being sold on the streets of Tripoli for $400 a piece. And they're all black, by the way. Because the U.S. actually, and I don't think it was necessarily their intention, but strangely, one of the pretexts for the invasion of Libya was a statement that, and this was recalled under Obama, the U.S. government claimed that Gaddafi was using black mercenaries to attack his own people. Very strange propaganda choice. By the way, that was totally debunked. It turned out that the black mercenaries, who, by the way, you could tell, you were told in the papers, you could tell who the black mercenaries are because they wore yellow helmets. Those were workmen helmets. They were construction workers. The black mercenaries were just guest workers from sub-Saharan Africa that Gaddafi invited in. They weren't mercenaries at all. But the black mercenary lie that people like Hillary Clinton promoted and Samantha Power had an important impact. And that was that people of black skin in Libya, which is also an Arab country, right? It's in northern Africa. So it has two different kind of identities. It's African, but it's also Arab. Black people were seen as enemies. And during, and especially after Gaddafi was overthrown, the jihadists that the U.S. backed to overthrow Gaddafi began a process of genocide against black people in Libya, in addition to other crimes. The point being, this was not good for the people of Libya, the overthrow of Gaddafi. They took the most prosperous country in Africa and made it one of the least prosperous. And that was the result. Again, no one cared. And to this day, no one cares. By the way, it's basically forgotten. When was the last time you read about Libya in the newspaper? Meanwhile, Seymour Hersh again would write an article, and this really gets him in trouble. I believe it was called Red Lines and Rat Lines. And he talked about how the U.S. would then use the weapons and personnel from the jihadist overthrew Gaddafi. They would transfer them to Syria and begin the process of the violent overthrow of Assad. This gets Seymour Hersh into trouble, and he, at that point, becomes more and more isolated in journalism, even though he won the Pulitzer Prize right here. He now is a Substack. He went from the New Yorker to the London Review of Books to a German publication to Substack, because the Western press rejected it for telling the truth. And so what happened in Syria in 2011 was that, yes, there were some peaceful protests against Assad, though actually 2010 was one of the more prosperous years economically for Syria, and actually Assad began to loosen up Syria in terms of the intelligence forces. He began to actually try to make it more, for lack of a better word, freer than his father had. In this sense of, the truth is the U.S. would exploit this. So there were peaceful protests against Assad, that is true, when you were told that. However, the jihadist groups that the U.S. and others, many others, were supporting, essentially exploited the peaceful protest to begin violent attacks on Syria, on police, military forces. And then, of course, Assad responded. Who's going to put up with that? And mostly Assad began attacking those terrorist groups, armed terrorist groups, not the peaceful protesters, but we were told he was attacking the peaceful protesters. And the war then began in earnest. And it was but it took years to lay the groundwork for this war. So I was in Syria in 2021. I'm sure others have been there, but I had the fortune of being taken to Douma, the town of Douma, and another town, Gibraltar, I believe, and they showed me the tunnels that these terrorist groups made to get into Syria from Jordan. They were incredible. You could literally drive a truck through them, right? This was not something made overnight. It took years to build these tunnels. So these terrorist groups would begin popping up in cities through these tunnels, and sometimes taking over cities. And when they did, they would enslave people, they would rape women. It wasn't pretty, but this was the people that the U.S. was supporting. We were told these were moderate rebels. Do you remember that? But then you would have sometimes U.S. officials admit, including Joe Biden at one point when he was vice president, you know, there aren't really any moderate rebels there. John Kerry said a similar thing. And that was the truth, that who predominated in Syria in terms of the offensive against Assad were these radical groups. And what was their goal? We knew what their goal was. So in 2012, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency put out a report. It was classified. It was either leaked or declassified later. So in 2012, very early on in this war, the DIA said that the West is supporting AQ in Syria, meaning Al-Qaeda, and that the goal of AQ was to set up a religious caliphate in Syria, meaning a mono-religious state that was and is intolerant of other religions, meaning Christians, Druze, Alawites, who are Muslim but practice a different version, Shia, and even some Sunni. They wanted a very radical, extremist, Wahhabist state. And our Defense Intelligence Agency, the U.S.'s Defense Intelligence Agency, said this. That's what they want. And yet the U.S. continued to support them. And Canada continued to support them. And Israel and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, a number of countries. So, for example, what did these groups do? Well, like in Malula, that I visited three times, Malula is one of the last cities in the world that speaks Aramaic, the language of Jesus Christ. It's one of the more important Christian pilgrimage sites in the world, has ancient churches there. The Free Syrian Army that Obama admitted to supporting sacked that town, kidnapped nuns, tried to burn the churches to the ground. Thank God the churches were stoned, so that didn't work so well. But their goal was to destroy Christianity in Malula. And I didn't even know this until I went to Syria in 2021. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about the world and different things. But I was surprised to hear that it was Hezbollah who came to defend the Christians, who came in from Lebanon and joined forces with the Syrian Arab Army to defend Mosul. They did the same thing in Homs when I visited a church there. It's the church, it has a very interesting name, it's the Church of the Holy Girdle of Mary. They claim to have a belt that the Virgin Mary wore. And the terrorists backed by the United States and others, again, tried to do the same thing there, tried to burn down a church that had been there since 69 AD, 69 years after Christ. And again, but thankfully, before they came, in fear that they would come, the Syrian Arab army of Assad helped remove the belt, and they, with the priests, brought it to another town and hid it there. And again, Hezbollah and the Syrian Arab army would come and defend that church and ultimately beat back the Free Syrian Army, so-called. But this was the type of thing they were doing. Of course, in Palmyra, they destroyed all kinds of ancient buildings. The curator of the museum there was killed defending the antiquities there in Palmyra, an incredible hero. And again, shocking, it was the West that was supporting these groups. And again, this is, at this point, not even seriously debated. And then finally, as I said, Al-Qaeda became victorious and is now leading, if you want to call it that, Syria. And they've engaged in genocidal acts against the Alawites, against Christians. Just last week, a church was attacked. 22 Christians were killed. By the way, you never hear about that, right? Trump talks about Nigeria, and he doesn't talk about Syria. And by the way, the rallying cry of the terrorists that the U.S. and Canada and others were backing against Assad, their rallying cry was Alawites to the grave, Christians to Beirut. They would kill the Alawites and send the Christians out to Lebanon. And guess what's happening? The Alawites are being sent to the grave and the Christians are being sent to Beirut. All of this was totally predictable. And again, even, so I talked to, I have friends in Syria still that I talked to. One woman is incredible. She was a journalist there. She was kidnapped very early in the war. And she was with two different, had a team of three people, including herself. One individual on her team was killed when they were kidnapped. The other individual from her team were saved by the Syrian Arab Army, which she was very grateful for. And she still lives in Damascus, and she wrote to me recently. She said, "Dan, Damascus, the Damascus I know is gone. The government has meticulously taken up all the Roman cobblestones from the Christian quarter and just paved over the street. The bars that used to be open there that I used to go to as someone who likes a glass of red wine once in a while have been closed. And if you walk the streets of Damascus now, especially if you're a man or woman, you'll be stopped and asked if you're married and what your religion is, etc." Again, that pluralism that existed in Syria for so long has been destroyed. Again, it's a tragedy of incredible proportions. And again, the sad part to me is that not enough people spoke up to defend what was there. It might have been, by the way, not perfect. I will concede that, right? But what has come is much worse than was there before. I'm certain of that. And so some folks may say, well, why? Why was this done? And why is it continuing to be done? Why is it being done in Gaza? where every mosque, every church has been leveled, where the ancient library holding all these ancient documents has been destroyed. Same thing in southern Lebanon, right? The St. Peter, St. Paul church there was destroyed, amongst many others. Why is the West supporting the destruction of churches and mosques and other ancient things, for lack of a better word? Well, I have a theory that I'd like to share with you. I think that, you know, at some point, well, as you know, for a long time, if you looked at U.S. foreign policy, the goal of U.S. foreign policy, well, the goal was always the same, and that was to maximize control, dominance over the world, to maximize exploitation of labor and resources, right? So after World War II, for example, the U.S., with only, I believe at that time, 5% of the world's population, it controlled 50% of the world's wealth. 50. After World War II. Even to this day, the U.S. is about 6% of the world's population, controls about 25% of the world's wealth. That's incredible. And when I say the U.S., I mean 10 guys there. Literally 10 guys, right? So, for example, and this kind of gets to my theory, you might recall that during the COVID pandemic, it was reported, and this isn't a question, that the 10 richest men, and they're all men, in the United States, their wealth more than doubled from $875 billion to $1.9 trillion. They were able to use the pandemic to steal from the poor and take the wealth for themselves. So this is the name of the game, but this gets into what I call the chaos theory now of modern capitalism. So again, the goal's always been exploitation and trying to get as much more wealth and as cheap labor as possible. The U.S. for a long time, and I'm sorry I harp on the U.S., but that's where I'm from, and I do focus. The Canada's at least a junior partner in all this. The U.S. decided for a long time, we're going to support strongmen in these countries, usually right-wing strongmen, who can guarantee that our corporations can go in and, again, get their wealth for very cheap, their resources for very cheap, exploit their labor for very cheap. And that worked out for a long time. But then they seized on another idea. They said, yeah, but you know what? The problem with these strongmen, even if they're our people, you know, as Roosevelt said about Somoza in Nicaragua, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. But even a son of a bitch, once in a while, if he wants to stay in power, has to provide something to the people. Right, has to build some infrastructure, has to provide some social benefits, and therefore has to do a little taxation of companies in the country, including international companies. Has to have maybe some tariffs also to raise money. Well, that's no good. That's no good. So they decided it's better to have no government at all. And the best example of this is a country you never hear about in the news, but I will talk about it. It's not Syria, though Syria is starting to look like that. But the most dramatic example of this in the world is the Democratic Republic of Congo. So, and it follows the pattern I just told you. So, first of all, you know that King Leopold of Belgium controlled the Congo from the late 1900s till the early 20th century. And it's well accepted he murdered 10 million Congolese under his tutelage. And he did so for the main purpose at that time of harvesting rubber. That was a big thing. For tires, a number of tire companies still get their rubber from there. There are some other resources, but that was the main thing. And if he basically enslaved the Congolese, and he would punish them by cutting their hands off if they didn't obey, right? By the way, the Congo ends up being taken away from him through public pressure, including from the Anti-Imperialist League, of which people, very good people like Mark Twain, members of. But then it was given over to Belgium, and they more or less continued the same thing, though not quite with the death penalty. So in 1960, Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba was elected, who wanted to do something very terrible for Congo, and that is to run the country for the benefit of the people. And so the CIA, along with the Belgians, murdered Patrice Lumumba, and they put in a dictator named Mobutu Sese Seko. So here's the old pattern: we're going to support a strong man, Mobutu, to run the country. And the U.S. supported him for years, for decades, until he decided, oh, geez, you know, they're going to kill me if I don't do something for the people. So again, he started doing some semi-progressive things in terms of social programs, taxation. So the U.S. got rid of him and basically installed nothing to this day. There's not a functioning government in Congo. So what is happening? You have children forced to work in the mines. You have the greatest mineral wealth in the world being exploited by everyone, paying almost nothing to get it. So this is the model. This is better than Mobutu. Nothing is better than Mobutu, and nothing is better everywhere. And so you see Libya, which is now total chaos. Syria now is nearly total chaos. Lebanon, Gaza is just leveled to the ground. Somalia, Sudan, Congo, that is the future, is chaos. So that the 10 guys who own everything can own even more. And when you look at what the U.S. is now threatening to do in Venezuela, for example, you got to look to Syria, you got to look into these other countries. That's the future for these people. They'd be better off with the government, is, you know, no matter how flawed that government might be, than none at all, than what is being planned for them. I think the other thing that I see more specifically about, in particular West Asia, or also called the Middle East, is that to the Western capitalists, they find the traditional values of the people there anathema to capitalism. People who still have ties to churches, to mosques, that provide social services for people, in which there's communities that share and don't just value money, right? That is anathema to the system. Those traditional societies must be destroyed, and they are being destroyed as we speak. And it's quite troubling. It's quite troubling. And unless we can resist this, it's coming home. It is coming home now. I'm seeing it in the United States with these crazy ICE detentions. Are you following what's happening with the U.S.? You know, that Trump has masked men on the streets without badges detaining people. At least 170 U.S. citizens have been detained by them. This is part of the chaos. This is part of the plan to even destabilize our countries so that we can be super exploited. I feel bad. I'm not giving you glad tidings, but this is what I see happening. Again, I'm not so sure exactly what's happening in Canada, but what I do know is that things like national health insurance, for example, are going to be at grave risk. You're going to have to fight to maintain this. In Great Britain, that's happening as well. And it's all the same struggle. And again, I think when you look at Syria, look at Gaza, you look at the lack of any moral or legal limits to what the U.S. and Canada and its allies will do in these places. The message is they'll do it to us, too. We're just going to be a little lower down the totem pole. Anyway, that is the end of my my speech in chief. I'm happy to talk about more, you know, hopeful things in the Q&A. But I mean, those are the thoughts I have. Anyway, today as I sit here, maybe tomorrow I'd be more optimistic. But anyway, this is what I see. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. I'd say that your speech flowed like water, but perhaps it was more vigorous than that as well. So I'd like now to have a thank you speech for Dan. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Professor Kevin McKay to come up. He's a professor at Mohawk College. He teaches social science, social studies. Not only that, he is vice president of OPSU Local 240, and it was recently at the OFL convention where three resolutions of significance were decided in favor of Palestine. So let's give a warm welcome to Kevin.
Thanks so much, Brendan, for and to Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War for this opportunity, and thank you, Dan, obviously, for that amazing talk, for the book you've written, for all the work you've done, the research, the writing. And I think as you said as you finished up your talk, given what's happening right now in Venezuela, given this repeating pattern, this destructive, vicious, predatory pattern that we've seen, you know, for decades now, it's critically important that people avail themselves of your work, that folks like you are doing that courageous work of telling truth, and of not letting these stories just fade into oblivion, these tragedies, right? Because of course then we know the tragedies are just gonna keep on happening. Unless we know the story of Syria, the story of Libya, you know, the story of Iran and Mossadegh and all of these stories, right, that our mainstream media, and even sad to say our educational institutions, they don't wanna touch it with a 10-foot pole, right? And that absence of truth, of history, is why we have Gaza. Again, it's why we have the threat in Venezuela right now. So I just think it is so incredibly important, you know, the work you do, that you're coming around to do these talks to, you know, as someone who, well, of course, I'm an academic author in Canada, which is even worse than probably what you're doing too, but I know you're not making out like a bin doing this, right? You're doing really important work disseminating truth. And, you know, from the bottom of my heart, I'm sure for everyone else here, I thank you so much for what you're doing. Please stay strong. Please keep doing it. And know that we're here in solidarity with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to me.
And that was Professor Kevin McKay from Mohawk College thanking Dan Kovalik for his talk on the book launch for Syria, Anatomy of a Regime Change. For those just tuning in, you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFM UFM, just playing the audio of that book launch that happened a few days ago. I think we have time for some of the question period, get you about 10 minutes of the question period. So it's just a question and answer period with a roving microphone, and we'll go right to the first question and Dan's answers as much as we have time for. So I'm going to go over to that now.
I'd like to thank you, Dan, for your presentation. Welcome you to District 6 of your union.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I noticed your scarf there. I like it, yeah.
Which of course, is on the territory of the Algonquin, the Anishinaabe, and the Haudenosaunee people. It's a very big territory, you know, material. And I reflect that, you know, I've seen this problem mentioned with the peace movement not being able to deal with these questions of Libya and Syria. Here in Canada as well as similar to the United States. And that really made us less effective. They did good work in Hamilton, obviously. So I have 2 points, just probably just to maybe fill out your presentation. One, the despicable role of Canadian peacekeepers you might want to look at. From the very beginning, it's important to note, Canadian peacekeepers arrested Lumumba and turned him over to the CIA and the Belgian police. You know, the Canadian peacekeepers did that, under United Nations intervention in peacekeeping. And similar, what happened in Libya, it was justified by United Nations under something called the responsibility to protect, which it is a whole framework introduced to United Nations through the liberal advocate here, Lloyd Axworthy, wrote a whole book on it. And that was the pretext. So it began as sort of a legitimate effort to carry out that doctrine, and then it rapidly dissolved into a straightforward overthrow of the legitimate government of Libya, you know, and you reflected on that. So if you do an ad edem, you know, don't forget to call out the Canadian.
You got it.
Peacekeeper.
Thank you.
And I don't know where we go from here. You didn't mention the role of Turkey sort of in perpetuating it, or the UN in perpetuating the situation in Syria. And I wonder if you have any guidelines that we can do to try and protect what's left of that socialist republic.
Yes, well, first of all, thanks for your comments. I appreciate them. Yes, I mean, Turkey obviously played a huge role. Again, there are so many actors, and we do talk about it in the book. We go through all the actors in there. Well, I think, first of all, there is a growing protest movement in Syria. That there's a lot of anger against this new government. You know, when the government first came to power, a lot of people took a wait-and-see attitude. They were like, well, maybe things could improve, we'll see. But a lot of people, now that they see what's there, especially the minority groups there, they don't like it, you know. So I think we need to support those groups. I think we need to be in solidarity with those groups. And we need to continue being critical of the new government in Syria. I mean, the Syrian friends I have there, they don't believe Syria's lost forever, right? I mean, they think it will return. Not on its own, through a lot of struggle, but... we should be part of that struggle. Just like we should be part of the Palestinian struggle as well. So, no, I mean, there is some hope there for sure. That's all I have to say on that.
Dan, I mean, I said it all up there. Thanks so much. The question I have for you is, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you think we can do better as the North American left to engage in this struggle. You know, to support whatever resistance is happening in Syria. I mean, interestingly enough, you've got a young Gaddafi in Libya now who's making some noise, right? So, I mean, there's resistance movements in these countries. But what can we do better in North America to engage this battle of ideas and hopefully get some wins, possibly?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. It's obviously kind of the $64,000 question, as we say. I mean, I think, first of all, it is educating ourselves. I think we need to always be critical of claims being made about other countries and other governments and other countries. And not to fall for, you know, attempts to vilify other leaders. That's not to say other leaders maybe aren't bad or whatever, but also it needs to be put into perspective what those leaders are facing, for example. You know, as was pointed out, for example, in Syria, the U.S. has been meddling in that country since at least back to 1946. In fact, the first regime change the U.S. supported after World War II was in Syria in 1946, overthrew the president then, even before the CIA was created. And that was even before Mossadegh was overthrown in Iran in 1953. And they've been meddling ever since. So then when people say, oh, well, it's a repressive government, well, the truth is any government would have a certain amount of repression if there was a much mightier government trying to overthrow them, right? I mean, there has to be some historical context. And as Noam Chomsky always points out, the more that the West pushes for regime change in another country, the more that country will become repressive by nature, right? And in fact, the goal is to produce that repression, so then you can use that repression to justify intervention. And this is the classic means that, in particular, the CIA has developed over the years. So the point is we need to be informed ourselves, and then the next step is to inform others and inform the public through work in the media, through letters to our newspapers. We need to challenge the narrative that justifies these interventions. Again, just judging from being an American, and probably you see the same thing, everyone opposed the last war. But then the next war is like, oh, well, this is different this time, right? It seems like, you know, it's like the Who song, but it's the opposite. We will be fooled again, right? And I think we just, you know, we need to really pause and think, well, that didn't go so well last time. So, and I think that's true with Venezuela now. I mean, now there's the big push to overthrow the government in Venezuela. We need to be outspoken about that. But again, education is so important. And I think social media is at least providing that opportunity, right? If you look at Palestine, for example, the opposition to what's happening there is because of social media, right? Because it was an alternative to the mainstream press, which continues to try to justify what's happening there. So, you know, we need to use social media and other means to educate ourselves and others. You know, if you have the ability, it's great to travel to these countries, to travel to countries that are being targeted for regime change. And frankly, to see the good in other countries, you know. Actually, it's funny. One of my favorite quotes is from George W. Bush, believe it or not. I doubt if he wrote it, but he did say it. And again, he was talking about the U.S., but it could apply to Canada. He said that. He said, in the U.S., he said, we judge ourselves by the best of our intentions, and we judge others by the worst of their conduct. And that is so true, right? Like, you know, with the Vietnam War, for example, yeah, the U.S. killed 3 to 4 million people, raped a lot of people, but they meant well. Literally, that is the line. And with other countries that are, you know, again, marked for regime change, every mistake they make is blown up into some justification for action. Like, one great example is Syria. After, you might recall, after the fall of Assad, every Western reporter that went to Syria went to one place, and that was Saidnaya prison. And they said, look at the horrible conditions here. This is why it was good Assad was overthrown. I could go to 100 prisons in America and say the same thing. In the U.S., 80,000 people are raped every year in prison. We have 2 million prisoners in the U.S., more than any country in the world in terms of absolute numbers and percentages, right? The point is you can bore down in any country and say, yeah, look at how bad this country is, and that's a reason for regime change. And we need to really, really push back on that and resist that. Because even when you come down to it, you know, like, I have a president named Donald Trump who I can't stand. And I'd like him to go away. But I don't want other countries to support Al-Qaeda to get rid of him. That is not good for me or my people. I don't even want another country to invade to get rid of them. I mean, you kind of have to start at that basic premise, you know? And when you do, you realize kind of the absurdity of this whole line of argument, I think. Anyway.
And that was Dan Kovalik, part of the question period at the book launch for the new book he authored with Jeremy Kuzmarov called Syria, Anatomy of a Regime Change. So here's what we're going to do. There was excellent material associated with this book and this book launch. So the Jeremy Kuzmarov interview that was done the week before or a few days prior on the Taylor Report is already online. Plus we have the video of the book launch, the audio of the book launch. So it's all going to be put together in a newsletter that's going to be sent out to subscribers of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. And then that newsletter is going to be posted on the webpage of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War at hamiltoncoalitiontostopthewar.ca. It will contain this audio, the audio of the book launch, as well as the video of the book launch, and a link to the interview with Dan's co-author, Jeremy Kuzmarov. So hopefully that's quite comprehensive. It's all excellent. We want to get a transcript of that Taylor Report interview up as well. Thanks very much for listening, and until next week, take care.